Welcome to the Jackalcast.
Hello, this is Steven.
And this is Steven.
And this is the Jackalcast.
Today, we have a wonderful interview for you with Howard Taylor, the man behind Schlock Mercenary, the online comic strip that if you are not reading it, then once you are done with this podcast, go to schlockmercenary.com and check it out. Howard has now been nominated this year for his fourth consecutive Hugo Award for Schlock Mercenary in the graphic story category. His newest book, Force Multiplication, the 12th in the Schlock Mercenary line, has been nominated for a Hugo Award. Howard has also been nominated in the Best Related category for his podcast, Writing Excuses, which he does with Dan Wells, Brandon Sanderson, and Mary Robinette Coel. They do a short 15-minute podcast, as in it is a writing excuse, the excuse to stop writing so that you can listen to their podcast. They do this podcast on the topic of writing genre fiction. So if you are an aspiring fiction writer and you are not listening to this podcast, you really should. I do not write genre fiction, yet I have fallen in love with this podcast because these four people are just having a blast talking about stuff that they love, and really that's entertaining to everybody, or at least it should be.
Absolutely.
I got to sit down with Howard in person at the Dragon's Keep comic shop in Provo, Utah, which is actually Howard's office, which is to say it's a drawing table in the corner of the comic shop. If you walk in, you will likely find Howard sitting there behind his drawing table drawing the comic strip, just there. So, you know, pop in and say hi and tell him the Jackalcast sent you, and he'll get mad at us probably because he'll be busy trying to write and draw. But it was a lot of fun.
So what is Schlock Mercenary about?
Schlock Mercenary is kind of the worst mercenary force that you've ever seen. Schlock is sort of is a character.
I believe the word you're looking for is carbosilicate amorph.
Okay. I was just going to say blob. Schlock is a blob who likes to shoot things, and he has a crew of other mercenaries with him, most of whom are fairly bad at their jobs, but it is a hilarious, hilarious comic. You know, it is science fiction, it is humor, it's the daily comic strip that you're not reading anymore because you don't get the newspaper.
Right.
One of the few webcomics I'm familiar with that actually runs on the daily format.
Yes, and he hasn't missed a date in a long time.
Yes. Will you talk a little bit about that? Howard was kind of planning on thinking maybe this would end up as a newspaper comic strip until we all discovered that newspaper comic strips, like newspapers, were going to cease to exist at some point.
Right.
But it is thoroughly enjoyable, and if you're not familiar with it, go check it out.
All right.
So here is my interview with Howard Taylor. And I am here with Hugo-nominated Howard Taylor. We are here at Dragon's Keep, which is, we are in the bowels of Dragon's Keep.
We are in the, deep in the role play home of Dragon's Keep. There's even somebody's big map on the wall behind Steve. None of you are benefiting from the video feed, I'm afraid, but yeah. it's a very nice map, complete with obsidian razor fields and forsaken tundra. I'm sure you can fill in the rest of the creatively named dangerous locations yourselves.
Absolutely. So this is your home away from home.
Indeed.
As I walked in, I found you just sitting in the corner working on, well, not actually working at that moment.
No, but I had stopped working.
But if, you know, one was not aware, it would have appeared you were just sitting there working.
Yeah.
So so this is where Schlock Mercenary happens.
It's about where about half of it happens. The scripting, most all of the writing happens at home, and then the penciling and the inking takes place here, and then I take it home to scan it and ship it off to Travis for coloring. But yeah, most of the magic, where the idea suddenly takes shape right here in plain view of people who don't know any better than to, you know, take photos and Twitter next month's schlock out to the world. Twitter. Tweet is the verb.
Yes, yes. Tweet. They tweet. I tweet, you tweet, they tweet on the Twitter. We at Jackalcast love you because completely accidentally you created our logo for us.
I created a logo for you.
At the 2011 Worldcon, a bunch of us were working on the newsletter and
I'm not even sure how you ended up there, whether we drug you in there or whether you went in of your own volition.
The way it came about, us cartoonists, we can crank out an illustration pretty quickly as long as what you want is a cartoon and not an actual illustration. Yeah. And so I was throwing down some cartoons for the newsletter, and I forget who it was that asked for it, but she said, you know, could you give us a jackal, like a space jackal?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's easy.
Yes, it was a kind of a space western themed convention.
Yeah, a space cowboy. Yeah, you wanted a space cowboy jackal because Reno was sort of a western themed Worldcon. So, western themed from our standpoint, from the casino's standpoint, it was, let's give you Star Trek slot machines.
Right. Well, because that's all the... That's all the mundanes now.
Wow. Wow.
So, Schlock Mercenary is your webcomic, which
yep.
you have been working on now for, what are we at, 12 years?
We're pushing 12 years. By the time this airs, we'll be real close to 12 years. June 12th is the anniversary. I started in June 12th of 2000. Actually, that was when it first went online. The first strips started taking shape under my pen in March of 2000. So, I've been working on this for a dozen years now.
So, according to the great mastermind that is Wikipedia, you have a degree in music composition.
I have a degree in music composition with an emphasis in sound recording technology.
So where does cartoonist get in there? How does the music composition
major? I've loved science fiction my whole life, and music was what I studied in school because I didn't realize that you could study becoming a science fiction author. And if I had it to do over, I don't think I would have studied how to become a science fiction author in school, because I think being a good science fiction author is about filling your head with lots and lots of interesting things and then figuring out enough of the writing, or in my case, enough of the writing and enough of the illustrating that you can crank a story out. But yeah, I did music and then ended up at WordPerfect Corporation, and shortly thereafter, Novell. By virtue of the fact that most of the music stuff that I'd been doing was being done on the Macintosh, and they need somebody who is intimately familiar with Macintoshes to give technical support to their poor customers. So I was a tech support weenie in order to pay the bills while I did music behind the scenes. And I remember back in 1995 thinking, you know, it'd be really cool to do a comic strip on the internet, but I have no idea how to even do that. I mean, the idea that an image file could be compressed smaller than bitmap was beyond me. I didn't know the first thing about it, and so I didn't even approach it. And then in 2000, I was reading a couple of web comics and thought, oh, this looks like an interesting way to tell a story. And the record company that I'd founded, which had been running from 95 to 2000, was foundering a little bit. Certainly wasn't making me quit my day job money. And so I started cartooning and immediately fell in love with it. Unloaded the record company shortly thereafter, started putting comics on the web, and within 4 years I'd quit the day job. And the rest, as they say, is... now you know the rest of the story.
There you go. The Paul Harvey. One of the things that I find interesting, and full disclosure, my webcomic exposure is fairly limited. There's lots of them out there, and I don't know them all. But yours was the first one that I'd seen, which, well, first is a daily strip.
Daily is unusual.
But it also, it takes the form of the comic as you would see it in the newspaper.
Yeah.
You know, that your six of your comics are, you know, single strips, and then your Sunday is a bigger, you know, as it would be in the Sunday comics. I mean, was there a thought that this might end up in the newspaper?
Yeah, I originally thought that, I could post it on the web for free, get good at it, and if it gets picked up by the newspapers, hey, fantastic, I've got a career as newspaper cartoonist. I did not, in 2000, 2001, 2002, foresee the demise of print journalism, nor the demise of, the comics page. I remember reading about, Burke Breathed and Bill Watterson's complaints with the comic pages, and I remember thinking, oh, yeah, they can only scrunch them down so far before, you know, it doesn't get any smaller. And that's actually not true. They can scrunch them all the way down to zero, and then the newspaper can fold and die. And it didn't even occur to me as I was creating my comic that other formats were acceptable. Now, I grew up on newspaper comics, and I remember reading compilations of the old 1940s era Buck Rogers, which were very similar to what I'm doing. You've got, you know, big installments on Sundays, smaller installments on weekdays and Saturdays, and it's a serial. It's telling a complete story. The difference between what I'm doing and what those were doing is that there was no accessible archive back then. So Monday caught you up on where we were in the strip and set you up for the strips that led up to Sunday, and then you started over again on Monday. And so almost half of what was being posted was recap in some way, shape, or form. But anyway, circling the wagons back around, I was very familiar with the format, and I realized that the 4-panel and then, you know, 9-panel or 12-panel or whatever format on Sundays was a syntax. And it was a syntax that I was familiar enough with that I figured I could tell a story in it. I didn't realize when I started how incredibly complicated it is to tell a story, an actual serial story that has in each installment beat, 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 punchline. And at times that's hampered the storytelling, and at times the storytelling has hampered the delivery of the punchline. But at this point, it is what it is, and I'm not going to mess with the formula.
So if you could kind of take us through a little bit your writing process.
Okay.
Because again, that's another thing that there certainly are other webcomics that tell continuous storylines, but a lot of them don't. So there's no need for plotting. You know, it is each strip is an independent beat, beat, beat punchline.
Yeah, I think Gary Tyrell of Fleen.com refers to it as evil continuity. Evil continuity, which, you know, I have to maintain at all costs. There are three basic stages to the writing. The first stage is what do I think would be cool? And it's what sort of a concept do I want to tackle? Do I want to look at, you know, what life extension really means? Do I want to look at, you know, the relationship between baryonic matter and non-baryonic matter? Do I want to look at the nature of God? The nature of good and evil, you know, these sorts of what do I want to explore? And the things that I've cited, I don't know that I actually set out to explore any of those in those ways. Sometimes it's just, you know, I think we should do a rescue mission. Rescue mission would be fun. So what does a rescue mission look like? And then I'll do a very rough outline, you know, less than 100 words, very, very rough outline of what I think the story will look like. And then I start writing strips. And writing a strip involves picking the characters who are going to appear on screen or on panel, on page, giving them dialogue, and positioning the dialogue in the panels so that I can imagine where the art goes. And I print that out. I print out the panels with the dialogue, and then I draw the bubbles on it and stick the characters and the scenery and everything else in there. But I'll write a week's worth of script and sort of move my way through the outline. We call this, a lot of people call this discovery writing, where you start writing the beginning before you really know what the end looks like. My discovery writing is a little more like walking through the fog and knowing that there are lampposts out there, but I can only see one lamppost at a time. And so I'll meander around with the plot and with the characters until I find a lamppost, and then I race for it. And meander around a little bit and race for the next one. And, you know, now that I've pulled the curtain back a little bit, folks might be able to see it happen and, you know, accuse me of meandering. But some of the most fun I have is in the meanderings. You know, it was a meandering that gave me the character, the longshoreman of the apocalypse. And the moment I introduced that joke, the moment I said longshoreman of the apocalypse, I knew I had a book title, I had a character, I had a climax. I dove back into the outline and tightened things up. once I get about two-thirds of the way through my projected outline, once I'm all the way through Act 1 and most of the way through Act 2, I sit down with my writing group and we look at what promises they, my writing group, my alpha readers, what promises they think I've made to the reader, what Chekhov's guns I've hung on which walls, what I've foreshadowed, what they think might be red herrings, what running gags they'd like to see come back. And it's very helpful for me to have them do this because in most cases, in many cases, you know, I'll listen to what they say, I'll look at what they've written down, and I'll realize, oh, I had completely forgotten that. Yeah, that would make a good running gag. Why didn't it occur to me to reuse that material? Well, awesome, the book just got longer and funnier. And then the last third of the book, I take all of the information from my alpha readers, feed it through the wood chipper of my brain, and extrude something pulpy and different. And that, I'm sorry, that metaphor just flatlined. so we're done with this question.
We'll find some more. You are no stranger to podcasts, as you do one of your own.
Yes, yes, I do one of my own. Although calling it one of my own
it is not your
unfair
own.
To the yes. 75% of the 75%, 80% of the folks. It's Brandon Sanderson, Dan Wells, Mary Robinette Kowal, and I are the talent. And then Jordo Sanderson is our producer. So there's five of us who work on the project.
Yeah, writing excuses. I had never listened to it before because it's a podcast about writing genre fiction, which is not something that I personally
do. It's a podcast for people who want to write genre fiction. So yeah, it's pretty niche specific. Podcasts about science fiction, about genre fiction, you know, anybody listen to that because
absolutely.
Everybody loves either science fiction or fantasy or horror or steampunk. There's nobody who just reads straight up fiction anymore, is there?
I'm sure you are right.
I can't imagine there being anybody like that. That's.
However, I have to say, in doing my research to interview you, I listened to several episodes, some of the earlier ones and some of the more recent ones. I absolutely adore it. I'm having an absolute blast listening to you guys talk because there is, you know, in addition to conversation about writing, there is conversation about the stories that have been written.
We have a really, really good time doing it, and I think if you're enjoying it, it's because we're having fun. And that's one of the rules of the podcast. We want to talk about things that are engaging to us, things that we enjoy, things that we're interested in, and that'll come across in the cast. We also decided to do a very fast-paced format, 15 minutes long, because you're in a hurry and we're not that smart. I'm very proud of that tagline. That was my contribution to the cast, was coming up with the tagline.
That's why they let you in?
That's why they let me in. And the result is that we do away with a lot of the banter, a lot of the I think of it as morning show radio type stuff that's just filler that radio hosts say instead of saying we try, I mean, we leave the ums and the uhs in, but then we jump straight into the meat of what it is we want to talk about, and we try and keep it very, very fast-paced.
Is there any editing at all that happens to that podcast, or is what is put up essentially how it...
Only under extenuating sorts of disastrous circumstances. Jordo does not like to edit. Bless his heart, he's the laziest audio engineer I've ever known.
That's okay. My partner, Stephen Nelson, who is the one who does all the editing for our podcast, you know, I do not envy, you know, if I had that talent, I would have to do that. Luckily, I don't have to.
When I worked on audio engineering projects, when you're mixing full musical sorts of things, you tend to spend about an hour of engineering time per minute of audio. You'd spend 5 hours on a pop song, just engineering it, just mixing it. That's not the recording session. Mm-hmm. With the podcasts, I think Jordo spends 25 minutes engineering each 15-minute episode, which pretty much just means applying the bumper at the beginning, stitching it together, and then listening to it and level checking it on the way through. So sometimes Brandon will say, halfway through an episode, he'll say, "Okay, Jordan, make a note. We need to stop here for a moment and collect our thoughts." And then Jordan will have to do something difficult and stitch, two half episodes into one whole one.
So in listening to them, I've sort of been able to parse out, first off, that the new episode of the week was probably recorded 3 to 6 months ago. Which I have to say, because your topic is not time sensitive, there's really no reason you can't do that.
Yeah, we used to record 3 episodes every 2 weeks, maybe 4 episodes every 2 weeks, and if we got too far ahead, we'd take a little bit of a break, or we'd only record 1 or 2. When Brandon and Dan started traveling a little more, when I started traveling a little more, we realized we needed to do some bigger sessions. And then when we brought Mary Robinette Kowal into the cast and realized that it was not cost effective for any of us to fly her into town bi-weekly, we said, well, let's fly her into town once every 3 months and see if we can record, a dozen or more episodes per session. And what we realized is that, or per session, per weekend. And what we realized is that on a, Friday, Saturday arrangement, we can lay down 20 episodes if we front load them properly. And then we go to conventions like Worldcon or World Fantasy and bring the recording equipment along and do a bunch of interviews. Mary has pointed out that, at least for her own career, being interviewed on Writing Excuses was very, very good for her. And apparently there are other authors who feel the same way. Whether mistakenly or not, I'm not going to disabuse them of the notion, because we're happy to talk to them because they provide so much insight that Brandon, Dan, Mary, and I are unable to bring. It's just always good to have a fresh perspective. So,
one point I do have to make, there was an episode that aired early in this season, I believe, with a discussion on flora and fauna. And on behalf of my wife, the biologist, if you could pass on to Brandon Sanderson her thanks for discussing the problem with the Na'vi in Avatar existing on a planet where every other life form is a hexapod.
Yeah,
I would appreciate if you could pass that on for her, because my wife, the biologist, that was her problem with that movie when she came out. And when he said it in the podcast, I was driving down the road and I just broke out in hysterics.
Yep, and I think Brandon pointed out, I don't know if this was in the cast or not, if they do a sequel, one of the world building things that's going to come out is why the Na'vi are bilateral symmetry, biped, two arms, when everything else is hexapodal. And, I like the fact that they've done that, or that, that exists back there, but for biologists and science fiction fans, the movie would have been so much stronger if somebody had said, hey, how come the Na'vi have two arms and two legs and everything else has six? Well, that's part of what we're here to find out.
Right.
And then we never find it out.
One of the things that I find most interesting about your podcast is the fact that you, all four of you, are in the same room. Obviously the three of you are here in Utah normally. When I listened to some of the early episodes, it was fairly clear that you were all in the same room. As I listened to later episodes, I'm guessing probably due to upgrades in recording equipment, you didn't sound like you were necessarily all, like you necessarily had to all be in the same room. And when I discovered that was in fact the case.
Yeah, we always wanted to record together because there's so much information that moves across the table inaudibly, allowing us to not step on each other's lines, allowing us to, wave our hands frantically and say, oh, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this. And Brandon say, okay. And Brandon finishes the question and we know who's going to answer it. The problem with doing these things over Skype or, heaven help us, cell phone, is that back channel communication is gone. And you'll have people talking and talking and talking because they're waiting for the interviewer to ask another question or waiting for somebody else to interrupt, and nobody else wants to interrupt because they're still talking. And so the table, all sitting around the same table, affords us a certain energy that I don't think we could have otherwise. And that's why we fly Mary into town, is so that she can be part of that energy.
So one of the main things that we like to talk about on this podcast are conventions. These crazy things that we all do.
I love conventions.
Why do you love conventions?
I love conventions because I like meeting my fans. I like drawing pictures for people. I like selling things from booths and making piles and piles of sweet, untraceable cash. Is this airing before or after April 15th? Doesn't matter.
Whichever you like.
It doesn't matter. Conventions are a lot of fun. We've been talking about writing excuses. I love doing writing excuses because I love talking about genre and working within the genre and creating things and consuming things. And at conventions, I get to have those discussions all the time. And sometimes it's in front of an audience on a panel, and sometimes it's sometimes it's in the bar at BarCon. So yeah, I love conventions. So far this year I've done two, although by the time this episode airs I will have done four.
I can say, I think as we record this, you're smack in between. You just got back from LunaCon.
Just got back from LunaCon. I'm headed out to the World Horror Convention, which is in Salt Lake this year. And I've got kind of a stealth role in the World Horror Convention this year. I'm on convention staff as the personal handler, well, handler's probably the wrong word, as the guest liaison for Mike Mignola.
Okay.
I'm a big Mike Mignola fan. This needs to not air before World Horror so that Mike doesn't get wind of the fact that a fanboy is actually his liaison. But I'm looking forward to that. And my job is to make sure that he has a great time at the show. And my job from my career's standpoint is to spend lots and lots of time listening to him talk and learning at the feet of one of the great monster creation, illustration, and storytelling masters.
Do you work at conventions often?
No. If this hadn't been local, there's no way I would have done it.
Sure.
And in fact, they actually wanted me to moderate a couple of panels, and I agreed. And then they said, well, it's so expensive to have a membership to the convention. Are you sure you want to come up, for just a couple of panels for $150 for membership? And I said, well, are you offering an alternative? And they said, well, if you're on staff, you only have to pay $25. Well, what do you want me to do? Well, Mike Mignola needs a guest liaison. Sold. Okay.
Twist my arm.
Yeah, exactly. It's it wasn't something that I volunteered for. It was something that they knew they could sucker me in with. I bring this up because if people listening to this are looking for people who are really, really good guest liaison sorts of folks, don't look for me. Look for somebody to be a guest liaison for me, and then let me come to your convention and be a moderator, because what I love doing is moderating panels.
Yeah? What is it about moderating that you enjoy?
I like ensuring that the discussion flows well, that everybody talks, that the questions get answered, that the topic moves ahead real quickly. My experience on writing excuses has enabled me to see, sitting there at the table, I can see when somebody's about to wrap up. I can also tell when somebody's going to hem and haw their way through the next 10 minutes, and I'll just stop them.
Unless you stop them.
I'll just stop them and throw the question at somebody else. I can tell when somebody in the audience isn't asking a question, when they're making a statement. As John Scalzi so famously put it, if you're going to ask a question, make sure you ask it in the form of a question, or I'll just cut you off. And I found that when you lay that ground rule out front, during a convention panel, people are pretty good about playing along. Especially, you don't usually have to do this, but if you let them know, hey, the panel is up here because we all have things that we really, really want to say on this subject. and the convention picked us to say those things, and most of the people in this room are here to hear us say those things. If you have a comment, make it quick and phrase it in the form of a question so that we can talk, because that's our job. And it's nice to be able to be the moderator, because that way I can be the designated jerk and everybody else on the panel gets to look good, you know, and shine and answer questions and be smart.
So did you attend, I mean, were you attending conventions as a fan before you were doing? Okay, so what was it part of the, you know, the business of I'm trying to write this comic and make a living out of it, so I'll go to conventions?
I had no idea what I was getting into. I had been to Comic-Con in 2001 and 2000. I think I went in 2001, 2002, and 2003. I went to numerous trade shows for Novell, and so standing in front of a group of hostile customers was, I ate that for breakfast and lunch and dinner for, you know, a week at a time. It was unpleasant, which is why, you know, a room full of science fiction fans who might be a little unruly doesn't faze me at all. The turning point was when I heard about this convention called PenguinCon, which was a blended Linux Expo sci-fi convention in Novi, Michigan. And I convinced Novell to send me on the Linux Expo side, because Novell was getting its feet wet in Linux. And I convinced the convention to put me on panels both for the Linux stuff as a Novell representative and as a sci-fi web cartoonist guy on the other side. And I went there and saw this whole new convention culture, was introduced to fandom, immediately fell in love with fandom. That was March, I think, of 2004, or May of 2004, somewhere in there. And by the end of 2004, I'd quit the day job, and I was doing conventions pretty regularly, and I loved them.
So how much time, so today, how much time do you spend, I mean, essentially a lot of what the convention is advocating for your work. How much of your time today do you spend with conventions and other forms of
I try not marketing? To do more than one convention a month for more than 6 months out of the year. So that's, yeah, six conventions a year. This year there are going to be 9 or maybe 10, but a couple of them are really short. One of them almost doesn't count. It's a one-day event and it's local. I've got 3 local events that I'm doing. I'm doing Gen Con, I'm doing the World Science Fiction Convention. Sandra had declared my schedule to be completely full, absolutely, irrevocably full. There is no more room for another convention. And then this guest of honor invitation came in for a brand new show called Convolution in the Bay Area, and Sandra conceded to allow me one more show in my schedule. I'm looking forward to that one.
Yes, as we are a West Coast based show, a lot of our focus is on the West Coast shows, and so the Convolution was something I was going to bring up. That'll be you will be one of the guests of honor there,
and I'm looking forward to that.
Did the convention lead to you being able to financially quit the day job and focus on the comic, or did the convention just kind of spark you to feel the need to do it?
The convention showed me that that this was a thing that I loved in ways that I didn't realize were open to me. The business development aspects of going to conventions were certainly not lost on me, as I realized that this was a good place to sell things. It was probably a much better place to sell things than Comic-Con had been. Comic-Con isn't a convention. Comic-Con is a giant expo. It's an enormous commercial event. It's nerd Mardi Gras. And there are sellers and retailers there who make good money. But I find that I make better money at the World Science Fiction Convention, which is 1/20th the size. 1/100th
yes,
the size.
If something How big was the last?
Yeah, somewhere in there. Yeah, one.
Were there any specific relationships, people that you met, mentors that helped you kind of get from where, I don't know, whatever that level is,
absolutely,
between I can make a living at this and not?
Were absolutely.
Was there anybody specific that helped you get there?
I think probably the first and the most important, and I've thanked him in several of my books, was Steve Jackson, who was a fan of the comic, and he and I met at that first PenguinCon. I say we met at that first PenguinCon. We met at Comic-Con International and had some fun talks. Met again at PenguinCon. Met later at down in Austin, and he was going to be my publisher. And then we realized that I couldn't make enough money having a publisher. I needed to self-publish and keep more of the money myself. And Steve gave me all sorts of tips on how to be your own publisher. And so in terms of the mentoring I've had, Steve Jackson tops the list. Now there were, half a dozen or more cartoonists who, helped me understand some things about the book printing process. Steve Troop in particular helped me with the layout and design of the Schluck Mercenary books. And then recently, my friend Richard Bliss has been fantastically helpful on the marketing and business development front. I learned all kinds of things from him when we were at Novell together, and now he does a podcast called Funding the Dream, which is a podcast for people who use Kickstarter to fund board games, which may sound like a tiny little niche, but board games and card games and RPGs have funded so far this year at, I think, $350,000 or $400,000. It's been a fantastic year for just on Kickstarter. There's been that much funding there. The list of people that I've met is hugely long, and I'm doing most of them a disservice by not mentioning them. But any relationship I enter into, any friendship, any conversation, I'm looking to learn something. And if there's something that I can teach, I'm very free with the information. At LunaCon, I sat down and talked to an artist who was, just hustling, selling art in the hall. And he and I talked for about, 10 or 15 minutes. And suddenly he realized, wait a minute, you're just making a living as a web cartoonist. And you're making a fantastic living. Well, not fantastic, Donald Trump. Not even fantastic, I have my old Novell salary back. But I'm paying all of my bills, and my wife doesn't have to work except for our business, and we have four kids and a house and two cars, and we're getting by just fine. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing that with a webcomic. And so suddenly he was all questions. How do you do this? Okay, now how would that apply to me? What do I need to do in order to make what I'm doing work more like what you're doing? And we had a great conversation for, 2 or 3 hours, broken up by his, hucksterism to the folks in the halls, because he still needs to pay the bills.
Sure.
I love talking about this stuff. I'm not the expert. I am an expert, and I'm one of the only experts at my business, specifically, Schluck Mercenary, the business. And I can tell you all kinds of things about it, but there's things that other people can learn from what I've done, and I'm happy to share the information. And when I'm at Convolution, when I'm at other conventions, that's one of the things that I love talking about.
So, let me ask you a question that's sort of related, because we have Schluck Mercenary, we have Writing Excuses, Schluck Mercenary itself is sort of branching off into some different areas. Somewhere in my research, I found that there is a Schluck Mercenary game.
There is a board game coming. I think pre-orders are open for that at gamesalute.com, and the game should ship in June.
So, it's a lot of what you're doing is related to Schluck Mercenary, but it is in different veins. You're dealing obviously with different businesses, different people. And then you have the wife and the four kids. How do you handle the time management side of all of that? How do you get all this stuff? How do you do it all?
I love to work, and I hate to not work. fundamentally, that's a personality trait. It's a personality trait that I've developed, and it's a personality trait that's easier to develop when you love your job. I didn't feel quite the same way about my job when I worked at Novell, but when I was working at Novell, I was putting in, you know, 90 hours a week between the day job and the comic. A large part of what you're seeing doesn't take as much time as you think it takes. The board game, for instance, I didn't need to develop the board game. I partnered with some people to develop the board game. They did all the board game development, and then they handed me the art requirements. And then I looked at the art requirements and broke it down into manageable tasks, which is something that, you know, when you've been drawing for a dozen years, you should be able to look at a list of art requirements and break it down into manageable tasks. And then made the decision to not draw comics for a couple of weeks and just draw board game art until it was all done, and then jump back in and catch back up on the comics. So that's one of the reasons I try and work the comic, you know, at least a month ahead, so that I've got the flexibility to go to a convention and you know, do a side project and do a bonus story for a book and do a bunch of margin art for a book and do a board game and then dive back into the comic and still have 2 weeks of headroom. So
I'm looking on the Twitter, and I understand there, this is a well, he actually hashtagged it with bias. I missed that the first time. There is a request, a biased request, to ask about your mobile apps. So tell me about your mobile apps.
I got an iPhone and suddenly realized that while I could read my website on the iPhone, I really, really wanted an app. And so I put out the call to the fans to, you know, I wanted to partner with somebody to develop an app. Now, understand, I didn't want a free app. When I say free, I didn't want somebody to just go and make me something for free because they loved me. I wanted to enter into a business relationship. And I was pretty sure that somebody out there who, you know, among my readers had the skill set and would be willing to enter into a business relationship with me. And so I did something that I still feel very, very clever about. I said, you know, send me a resume and send me a business proposal and, you know, I'll get back to you. And I just posted that to the wind. And I got lots and lots of responses, and the vast majority of the responses were along the lines, I made an app once, here it is, I love Schlock Mercenary, you're awesome. You know, they were very flattering, and in many cases the apps were just fine, but nobody sent a business proposal. Several people said, you know, what do you mean by a business proposal? Which is a step closer, you know, you're willing to ask the right sure. question. I say nobody sent a business proposal. Gary Henson of Plus 14 sent a business proposal, and I looked at his app, and, you know, the app that he'd done before was something that I was never going to use, but it was shiny. It was a geolocator sort of thing, where some of the others had been games that I would actually play. but, you know, his app was clean, and the resume looked good, and the business proposal, I could tell from the business proposal that he understood the business of apps. And so he and I started talking about it, and development proceeded apace. And now we have what I believe to be one of the very, very best. I'm gonna go ahead and say this, one of the top five comic reading apps available anywhere. It's very, very clean, comic specific. You know, specific to one comic. I don't think there's anything out there that's as good as what Gary's built. Specifically because it lets me upload things to the server and then define panels so that on the iPhone you can zoom panel to panel to panel, and I've defined it. You don't have to carefully position it with your finger. It's very, very flexible. Or not flexible is the wrong word. It's very, very intuitive. And once you get into it, it's just, you know, tap, read, tap, read, tap, read all the way through. The archive system is great. And I said earlier, you know, I didn't want a free app. It's a free app supported by ads, and you can subscribe and get it ad-free. And if you subscribe, you get to read Schlock Mercenary 3 days before everybody else does. And quietly lorded up over them when something suspenseful happens on the web, and you can say, yeah, ha ha, I already know what happens. He lives, or he dies.
Or he dies, and then he lives.
Or we cut away to the galactic core, and we still haven't found out. So,
excellent. Well, that's about all that I've got. So we look forward to having you on the Left Coast in November, and enjoy your other conventions.
I don't know. Folks on the right coast lean pretty far left, too.
This is true. Yeah, I don't know why that's true. Why do they call it the Left Coast? Because it's really both coasts are fairly left.
Yeah.
It's
the megalopoli, the megalopoli lean left, and the agricultural communities lean right. So,
excellent. Well, thank you again for the logo, and
thank you for
your time, and good luck with this year's Hugo Awards.
Ah, indeed. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to collecting another couple of pins.